Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, it's Potpourri Show number 7, with a little help from Dave Zirin, Tom Lehrer, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and George Carlin. I hope you'll stay tuned. It's potpourri time again. Potpourri number 7 in our occasional series. Potpourri is a bundle of herbs and flowers with a pleasant smell. In centuries past, people carried potpourri with them as they walked about the city, to ward off the foul smells of the city. Urine, human and animal excrement, smoke from burning wood and coal, offal from the slaughterhouses and butcher shops, and whatnot. Jonathan Swift wrote a nice description of what you are trying to avoid. Here's a comic poem where he describes London in the year 1710. His poem is titled, A Description of a City Shower. It's a parody of a classical pastoral poem. I'll read most of the last stanza. There's been a sudden rainstorm in London. In the first line, the word kennels means gutters. Swift writes, Now from all parts the swelling kennels flow, and bear their trophies with them as they go. Filth of all hues and odors seem to tell what streets they sailed from by the sight and smell. They, as each torrent drives, with rapid force from Smithfield or St. Pulchra shape their course. Sweepings from butcher stalls, dung, guts, and blood, drowned puppies, stinking sprats, all drenched in mud, dead cats and turnip tops come tumbling down the flood. So, potpourri is what we need to help us navigate the foulness of the day. Also, potpourri is a mixture of this and that, a hodgepodge of ingredients, and our show today is so structured. We'll hear from Dave Zirin, Mumia Abu-Jamal, George Carlin, and yours truly. Let's start with yours truly and Carlin. I'm speaking in late January 2020, and the Super Bowl is approaching. I know this from the weekly supermarket ads. Stop and Shop Markets wants to help me stock up on chicken wings, Doritos, pre-cooked shrimp, sliced ham, and light beer for game day. You have to call it game day because Super Bowl is a registered trademark and may not be used without paying money to the gods of sports capitalism. I just said Super Bowl, so sue me. This will be Super Bowl number 50-something. I don't know the exact number. I have a perfect record. I have been alive for all of them, and I have never watched a single minute of the darned things. I find professional football abhorrent in its economics, politics, tone, values, social effects, cost, and treatment of its workers, with college and high school football only a little behind. As it turns out, I'm not a baseball fan either. I live with a woman who, for reasons known but to God, is a big Yankees baseball fan. Our house is free from all televisions, but, like it or not, I do get to hear every Yankees game on our living room radio. I have no interest in baseball, but I don't find the game objectionable. It is not morally, socially, and ethically repugnant, as football is. Forced to watch one of the two games, I'd pick baseball every time. George Carlin explained the differences between the two sports better than anyone else. You've probably heard his analysis before, but how recently? It's time for a refresher course.
I'd like to talk a little bit about baseball and football. It's starting with baseball. Baseball is different from any other sport in a lot of different little ways. For instance, in most sports, you score points or you score goals. In baseball, you score runs. In most sports, the ball or the object is put in play by the offensive team. In baseball, the defense puts the ball in play, and only the defensive team is allowed to touch the ball. In fact, in baseball, if an offensive player touches the ball intentionally, he's out. Also, most sports, the team is run by a coach. In baseball, the team is run by a manager. And only in baseball does the manager or the coach have to wear the same uniform the players do. Can you picture Bill Parcells in his New York Giants uniform? Now, baseball and football are different from one another in other kind of interesting ways, I think. First of all, baseball is a 19th century pastoral game. Football is a 20th century technological struggle. Baseball is played on a diamond in a park, the baseball park. Football is played on a gridiron in a stadium, sometimes called Soldier Field or War Memorial Stadium. Baseball begins in the spring, the season of new life. Football begins in the fall when everything is dying. In football, you wear a helmet.
In baseball, you wear a cap.
Football is concerned with downs. What down is it?
Baseball is concerned with ups. Who's up? Are you up? I'm not up. He's up.
In football, the specialist comes in to kick.
In baseball, the specialist comes in to relieve someone.
In football, you receive a penalty.
In baseball, you make an error.
Whoops. Football has hitting, clipping, spearing, blocking, piling on, late hitting, unnecessary roughness, and personal fouls.
Baseball has the sacrifice.
Football is played in any kind of weather. Rain, sleet, snow, hail, mud. Can't read the numbers on the field, can't read the yard markers, can't read the players' numbers. The struggle will continue.
In baseball, if it rains, we don't come out to play. Baseball has a seventh inning stretch.
Football has the 2-minute warning.
Baseball has no time limit. We don't know when it's going to end. We might have extra innings.
Football is rigidly timed and it will end even if we have to go to sudden death.
In baseball, during the game in the stands, there's kind of a picnic feeling. Emotions may run high or low, but there's not that much unpleasantness.
In football, in the stands during the game, you can be sure that at least 27 times you are perfectly capable of taking the life of a fellow human being. Preferably a stranger.
And finally, the objectives of the two games are totally different. In football, the object is for the quarterback, otherwise known as the field general, to be on target with his aerial assault, riddling the defense by hitting his receivers with deadly accuracy, in spite of the blitz, even if he has to use the shotgun. With short bullet passes and long bombs, he marches his troops into enemy territory, balancing this aerial assault with a sustained ground attack which punches holes in the forward wall of the enemy's defensive line.
In baseball, the object is to go home and to be safe. I hope I'll be safe at home. Safe at home.
And furthermore, the oil companies could not keep the poisonous nature of leaded gasoline a secret forever. The tobacco industry could not keep the cancer-causing and addictive nature of tobacco smoke a secret forever. Football, too, has a deadly big secret that it is failing to keep a secret. Inevitable brain damage to all players. From concussions, and also from less than concussive bangs and tumbles. No helmet can prevent the injury. Anytime your body's forward motion is arrested suddenly, your brain continues to move forward until it smashes into the front of your skull. That's Newton's first law of motion. Nothing has to touch your head. If an opponent's shoulder bangs into your chest, you both will incur minor brain damage. Minor brain damage adds up and becomes major brain damage. The public is growing more aware of the problem, and we're seeing some changes made in professional, college, and especially high school football. In January 2019, sports analyst Dave Zirin discussed the problem with Ralph Nader on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Here is Nader interviewing Zirin.
I want to start with something that is affecting grassroots America in sports, and that is the major revelations in recent years of concussions, not just in professional sports or big-time college sports, but in high school sports. There's an estimate that about 20% of all high school football players suffer concussions before they graduate. And there is now a modest movement urging the abolition of football at the high school level. There are lawsuits, tort law lawsuits, by injured players now in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, suffering from severe brain damage. Some of these settlements have not been adequate, in my judgment, but they produced even more information. You've been talking about this for a long time. How do you see it resolving, both in terms of on-the-field testing, instead of saying, get out there again, Buster, you know, after suffering a concussion, all the way to the status of high school sports?
Well, big picture, concussions and chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE, they represent an existential threat to what is the largest sports empire in the United States, professional football. And it really is remarkable if you look at, say, the top 20 watch shows of the last year. I believe 19 of the 20 were NFL games at some time or another. Ratings are up this year. The Super Bowl is more watched than ever. And it's remarkable, given our fraying attention and our culture of distraction, that you still have this one focus on football. So its importance to America and the American psyche has never been more pronounced than it is in 2019. And yet this issue of head injuries, much more so than anybody kneeling during the anthem or sniping with Trump or any such nonsense, that's what represents the true existential threat to the sport. And my belief about where this is going to go is, it reminds me of a quote from James Reston, that we're much more adept at understanding revolution and evolution. There is an evolution going on. It may take 50 years, but there is an evolution going on where I think the sport is going to eventually leak out the next generation of talent, particularly because of concerns about the high school level. And the more we learn about concussions, I think the more difficult it's going to be to ensure these programs, just to make them legally viable, affordable. In your typical high school district, it's going to be something to watch, because it threatens the underpinning of this American institution that so many people have so much stock in.
So the fear of legitimate liability is freaking out the insurance companies who insure high school sports all over the country. Do you think 10, 20 years from now, there will be more than a handful of big-time high school football sports programs?
I think there's going to be a whole network of liability releases, that there's going to be pressure on families and minors to sign. I think there's going to be huge swaths of the country where it just does not exist anymore. And I think that there's probably going to be private funding, not similar to the AAU leagues in basketball, which is going to further, though, winnow the talent, because it's going to mean that the typical folks who play football at the high school level, and the typical talent bases in places like rural Florida and Texas and California, they tend to come from very poor communities. And for those families who don't have the option to pay for private leagues in order to be recruited out of, it's going to winnow the talent even further and further undercut the ability of the sport to be competitive and to be interesting. In many respects, I think boxing is a useful parallel in that it can still generate excitement, but it's nothing close to the broad-based popular sport that it was 50 years ago.
You know, more and more parents are getting the grim reality. They don't want their youngsters to end up with serious brain damage when they're in their middle age. And they're pulling their students back out of high school sports. Also, more and more parents realize that better helmets don't decrease the level of concussions.
In many respects, these new age helmets actually make it more dangerous because it's more difficult to see the damage that's being done. I mean, oddly, if players were still wearing those leather helmets, counterintuitively, one would at least see the bruising and damage on the face or on the side of the head, which would give an indication that a player needs to come out of the game. And yet, without seeing that physical exterior damage, it's more likely for a player to be sent back in or a player to feel pressure to go back in and try to deny the effects of concussions.
Let's talk about soccer heading. Where are you on that?
Sure.
In terms of concussions?
Yeah, just I live in a community where heading the soccer ball at the youth level is not allowed. And that's something that you're seeing more and more in youth soccer around the country. It's becoming the norm, actually, in youth soccer, as opposed to it being seen as an exception as recently as 10 years ago, or seen as some far out, ridiculous overreaction by overly concerned parents. But we know a lot more now than we knew 10 years ago, and we know the threat of heading in terms of concussions. And that's the main thing about this issue, Ralph, that I think people have to get their, pardon my expression, their heads around. And that's that science is not a friend of football. And the same way science was not a friend of the heading of soccer balls. The more we know, the more we know how deep the damage can be. And the more it creates, I think, not just a sporting question or a medical question, but it creates an ethical question about whether our society, particularly our universities, should be underwriting something to such a profound degree that causes brain damage.
And well, you know, the Ivy Leagues, if I'm not mistaken, have now initiated a rule where there is no contact in their football programs during practice, just in regular games, which is too late for Steve Skovran, who was a Yale football player back when. Sorry,
yeah.
Steve.
Right. Yeah, I'm feeling the effects, as you obviously can tell.
Is that true?
No, yeah. Actually.
I was a safety.
I never hit anybody. You know, that I'm not sure of. I don't know it on that molecular level. That's actually a piece of new information that Dave has given me. It wouldn't surprise me. And when I played, we did have contact during the week, maybe during the season, 2 days of the week. So it wouldn't surprise me that they've cut it out.
Yep, that is the case. It was described in the New York Times as an extraordinary step when they first initiated this in 2016. But, you know, I got to tell you that you're also seeing some signs of that in the National Football League, where they've eliminated a lot of the full contact practices. And again, this is about science not being a friend of the sport itself. And by the way, it's interesting, by the way, that the NFL has taken greater steps to do this than, say, the Southeastern Conference. And it's because NFL players have unions, and therefore they have more power than your typical college player to actually enforce their will about how these practices are run. And one thing we know is that it's not the big hits that you see on Sundays that make the crowds ooh and ah. That's not what causes the concussions. It's the repetitive, what are called subconcussive hits that happen every time you say hike and the two sides of the line crash into each other. And so if you eliminate that kind of practicing, you actually are doing the players, you know, a great deal of good.
Sports scholar Dave Zirin, interviewed by Ralph Nader. Time for a musical interlude. American football began in college, in the Ivy League, around the beginning of the 20th century. Its purpose was to toughen up the privileged sons of the ruling class. The kids were perceived as too soft to carry out the hard work in foreign soil, promoting America's new public mission of imperialism, conquest, and control. The powers that be wanted tough, patriotic, imperialist warriors like President Theodore Roosevelt. Incidentally, that's when the term sissy was invented. The original meaning of sissy was a young man who didn't care for football. True fact. Football's legacy of toughness, jingoism, and imperialism persists today. Try to find a televised football game today without some celebration of the fighting heroes of our armed forces, keeping the world safe for freedom and corporate capitalism. Still, the Ivy League roots of the NFL seem odd. It's hard to picture the Ivy League as a hotbed of muscular, knee-jerk, jingoistic, head-smashing imperialist goons. Notre Dame, sure, but Princeton? What about the University of Pennsylvania? What are they, the fighting Quakers? Go, Quakers, fight, kill! Can you imagine anybody saying that? Tom Lehrer noticed that his local citadel of ivory-covered learning, Harvard, had a football team, but alas, no fight song. In 1953, he proceeded to remedy the deficiency with the following result.
Fight fiercely, Harvard. Fight, fight, fight. Demonstrate to them our skill. Albeit they possess the might, nonetheless, we have the will. How we will celebrate our victory. We shall invite the whole team up for tea. How jolly, hurl that spheroid down the field and fight, fight, fight. Fight fiercely, Harvard. Fight, fight, fight. Impress them with our prowess. Do, oh fellows, do not let the crimson down. Be of stout heart and true. Come on, chaps, fight for Harvard's glorious name. Won't it be peachy if we win the game? Oh, goody, let's try not to injure them. But fight, fight, fight. Let's not be rough, though. Fight, 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 and do fight fiercely. Fight, fight, fight.
The great American satirist Tom Lehrer from 1953. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a radical black activist and journalist. He was a major thorn in the side of established power in his hometown of Philadelphia. Mumia was present when white Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner was shot and killed in 1982. Mumia was convicted of murder in a very dubious and controversial trial, with, shall we say, reasonable doubt aplenty. He was sentenced to die. In 2011, a federal court overturned Mumia's death sentence, but not his conviction. He is now serving for life without possibility of parole. While in prison, Mumia has written 10 books and telephoned out a series of spoken essays. Strikingly, none of these essays pleads his own case. They address larger social issues in America, and very intelligently. This recent short talk by Mumia discusses his new book. It's about the national security state. I especially like the talk because it discusses a historian I admire greatly, and whose voice has appeared often on New World Notes. That is the late Howard Zinn. Here is Mumia, introduced by another familiar voice, Glenn Ford.
Mumia's latest book is a trilogy titled Murder Incorporated that explores the history of U.S. imperial crimes. Abu Jamal says he was inspired by the work of the late Howard Zinn.
Years before we worked together, my co-author, Stephen Vittoria, and I talked about Howard Zinn and his masterpiece, The People's History of the United States. We both were admirers of Howard, and we loved his work, and perhaps especially his ideas of what was called history from below, or how regular people, average everyday people, made important contributions to the nation's history by building movements for freedom, justice, and real human rights. Zinn, who grew up in New York's tenements, was such a man himself, and he embraced humanistic working class ideas. As a young teacher in the Jim Crow South, he saw everyday people, like his students at Spelman College, get beaten and arrested for daring to demand the right to vote. These events taught Howard about history happening right before his eyes, where he had a bird's eye view of the civil rights movement in Georgia and beyond. These experiences inspired him and supercharged his reading, research, and writing of true U.S. history. And Howard inspired us, Stephen and I, to write our own history, Murder Incorporated, which we invite you to read so it can inspire you. For Murder Incorporated and my co-author, Stephen Vittoria, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And for New World Notes from Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening. NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com. Thanks, too, to Black Agenda Radio for Mumia's talk, and thanks to Ralph Nader Radio Hour for our excerpt from the Dave Zirin interview. Illegitimate non-carborundum. Keep trying to live each day as though the truth were true. Do something useful on Super Bowl Sunday, why don't you? And please tune in again next week. Till then.